The effects of that downturn can be heard in the wrenching personal stories of Las Vegas residents looking for work. From Nevada Public Radio, Adam Burke has the story of one of the city's newest unemployed.
A week ago Saturday, 41-year-old Lorraine Valdez lost her job at a printing company. But that's just the latest in a series of employment woes that have hit very close to home.
My sister just got laid off. My daughter, my son, my boyfriend. There's like 10 people, just immediate family, that are looking for work.
Valdez is eligible for unemployment, but what she really wants is a job.
E258.
By Tuesday, she's with her boyfriend and her daughter, waiting in the lobby of Nevada Job Connect. That's the state-run program that pairs job seekers with potential employers.
T256.
T256?
Yes.
Valdez's boyfriend, Michael, fidgets with several rolled-up forms.
I took auto tech in school, and I found out I was better with my hands. So hopefully I can try to find a job doing oil changes or cars or machinery.
Valdez's 24-year-old daughter, Alicia, sips an iced coffee.
Preferably looking for a bartending job because of the tips and stuff, but I'll just take whatever.
The three live together with Alicia's young daughter in a small apartment. Valdez says they've scraped together enough money for this month's rent and half of next month's.
I'm good till the end of December, but after that, we might have to move in with my other daughter.
Hey, so I heard you haven't been here for quite a while.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Lorraine Valdez eventually sits down with an employment counselor named Krista Marshall, who sorts through the pros and cons of Valdez's resume. 10th grade education, but willing to pursue a GED. Limited computer skills, but some valuable work experience.
But in your marketing and merchandising, that might be an easier fit for you as well. Plus, again, you have some
skills. Valdez has a clear, unvarnished view of her own history and where it's taken her.
I had babies really early in life. I had my first baby at 16. I started working immediately. I've been working since I was 14 and a half.
Still, the work has changed for Valdez over the years.
These days, it's not really labor and hands-on kind of stuff. It's more technical and using your brain. And I don't have a lot of education in that, so I need to go get that.
The city is seeing the end result of public and private policies that did not focus on developing the workforce, developing our human capital.
John Restrepo runs an economic and public policy research firm in Las Vegas. During the growth boom of the last few decades, low-skilled workers flocked to the city by the hundreds of thousands for jobs in construction, the service sector, and retail. It was an extremely rapid but quite shallow kind of economic growth, one that's evaporated quickly in the recession. And now, Restrepo says, workers like Lorraine Valdez face a few very limited options.
They have to either retrain themselves or leave town. Because if they're sitting around waiting for those large numbers of low-skill wage jobs to come back to the resort industry or the construction industry, which is the major employers of low-skill workers, that's not going to happen.
But those are the words of an economist. In the face of gloomy statistics, Lorraine Valdez believes she has to press on.
I can't just lay down. I got to keep going. If I do the right thing, something will happen. Some door, some way, somehow will open up and give me a chance.
And in the short run, doors seem to be opening for Valdez. A few days later, she has an interview with a cab company and a lead on a seasonal gig in a toy store, something that might keep her going, at least through the Christmas season. For NPR News, I'm Adam Burke in Las Vegas.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Last week, I paid my first visit to Las Vegas, Nevada. It reminded me of what writer Somerset Maugham said about Monaco, a sunny place for shady people. When the sun goes down, countless neon signs light up the strip. From my hotel balcony, I could see the fake Eiffel Tower at the Paris Hotel and Casino and the fake Empire State Building at New York, New York. A block away at Bally's Casino, there's a huge billboard advertising an old-fashioned showgirl extravaganza that's been running for decades, Jubilee.
Welcome to Las Vegas and to our show, Jubilee.
At night, a slow-moving snake of brake lights makes its way up the strip. On the sidewalks, people gawk, take pictures, slurp supersized daiquiris and novelty cups, and try to decide where to go next. Hustlers shove pieces of paper into pedestrians' hands.
Nightclub passes, strip club passes. No line, no cover, free admission. Any club, any
There is no shortage of ways a visitor can spend money here. Gambling is a big industry, and everywhere you go, from the fancy hotels to the gas stations, you hear this. But for many Las Vegas residents, it's been a different story. Since the recession hit nearly 3 years ago, some of them have fallen on tough times.
E200.
At the unemployment office, a staffer calls out ticket numbers for Las Vegans who hope to find work in a metropolitan area where the unemployment rate has reached 15%, the highest in the country. The area also leads the nation in foreclosure rates. Construction has come to a standstill on several mega properties on the Strip. The Fontainebleau Las Vegas Resort, the Echelon Hotel, the Plaza Las Vegas. Empty lots stand now where some older hotels and casinos were demolished. The picture used to be different.
It was sort of a common joke that the state bird or the county bird, the city bird for Las Vegas was the building crane, a landscape littered with high-rise development and projects going up.
That's Jeremy Aguero, principal analyst with Applied Analysis, a Nevada-based urban economic research firm.
You go back to 2006 and 2007, and the risks were that we couldn't find enough people to work in all of the hotels and casinos that we were constructing. The concerns were that we wouldn't have enough affordable housing for the workforce. You know, that contrasts incredibly sharply with what we see today. Half-built, stalled structures along the Las Vegas Strip and in our suburban areas, you know, are certainly monuments to an expectation that was there that never materialized.
Is there any new construction going on?
Oh, very little. I mean, the new construction that we're seeing is largely associated with government-related projects. Certainly, we have some transportation projects going on. City of Las Vegas is working to develop a new city hall. We've got a performing arts center in the downtown Las Vegas area. And certainly, there's some major projects that are finishing up construction. Things like the Cosmopolitan Hotel and Casino, a multi-billion dollar project, is out there. You know, those stand, of course, in stark contrast to all of the major construction projects that are half-finished today, both along the Las Vegas Strip and in what have been for a very long time very affluent suburban areas.
Analyst Jeremy Aguero says Las Vegas didn't necessarily go wrong. Economic cycles happen, and the city got caught up disproportionately. In the boom times before the recession, Vegas led the nation in population growth, employment growth, income growth, but that led to overinvestment and overbuilding, he says. On his company's website, a ticker scrolls the latest stats. Red or green arrows point up or down on figures for home sales, hotel occupancy rates, visitor volume, gaming revenue. I asked Aguero what people are looking for.
I think everyone's sort of looking for that sign that we've hit the bottom, right? That they can be comfortable that the housing prices aren't going to continue to decline, that they can feel like I'm secure in my job, that the nation as a whole is heading in the right direction, that they can feel somewhat more confident about the community. I don't know that people are looking for one indicator to flip from one side of a ledger to another side of a ledger or to have a chart sort of show it be a little bit differently. But what they're looking for is that sort of consistent sign or that comfort level, almost a psychology to it all, that the worst is behind us. And, you know, I think there's a growing momentum that some of that's there, but that is met with a healthy dose of skepticism, just given how difficult this recession really has been on a community that's just not accustomed to that type of economic downturn.
Charlie Chaplin was very lonely.
That's the fictional advertising executive Roger Sterling in the hit TV show Mad Men. He's played by the actor John Slattery. And in the show's most recent season, Roger Sterling is working on a book.
Why am I talking about silent movies?
Part of the chapter on your childhood?
That part of my book is getting bigger and bigger. Why is that?
The book is a tell-all account of life on Madison Avenue, full of drinking and womanizing and cigarette-filled boardrooms. And this week, we found out that the book is real. It's real enough to pick up at your local bookstore. It's called Sterling's Gold, Wit and Wisdom of an Ad Man.
Gentle reader, after devoting most of my life to the nefarious trade known as advertising, I thought it was time to share some of the pearls that I've been fortunate enough to accumulate. So here it is. A few things overheard, a few things to live by, and, hell, a few things I've apparently said and had repeated to me the morning after a party when I called to make amends. As I said, advertising's been half my life, and I'm probably off by 50%. But damn it if it hasn't felt like 15 minutes.
That's actor John Slattery reading the introduction to Sterling's Gold. It's a collection of quotes and quips and other witticisms from the character's many, many unforgettable lines. Now, of course, they're mostly the work of Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner, but they're all spoken by John Slattery on the show. And this past week, I spoke to John Slattery, and I asked him to share a few of his favorite nuggets of Sterling's Gold.
Here's one. This is when he's drunk in a phone booth. And I didn't even see this until I read it a few times.
This should be good.
They're self-so righteous.
And they're self-so righteous.
And I thought it was so self-righteous, and I realized that's how drunk he is. They're self-so righteous.
And they're self-so righteous. I never pissed my pants. This guy Rutledge killed a man with a motorboat.
Killed a man with a motorboat.
You know what gets you over something like that? Drinking.
I was surprised at how many there were. Actually, I had forgotten. I mean, it's been four seasons and, I don't know, 150 pages of these things. And all of them, really without the aid of context, are great lines.
I'm being punished for making my job look easy. I like that one.
Yeah. You know what my father used to say? Being with a client is like being in a marriage. Sometimes you get into it for the wrong reasons, and eventually they hit you in the face. That's a good one.
They say once you start drinking alone, you're an alcoholic. I'm really trying to avoid that.
That's great. What a prince. Well, that was an early one. He's looking at a room service tray. And he says, oysters, Rockefeller, beef, Wellington, Napoleons. We leave this lunch alone, it'll take over Europe. They're great. I mean, I really feel lucky to have been able to say them.
Let me ask you about Roger Sterling, because he, of course, is he's the child of a wealthy father. He inherits the family business. He's basically a sexist. Alcoholic, sort of racist. I guess he's a man of his era. What is it about Roger Sterling that should appeal to any of us?
I think Roger is unafraid to say what most people are thinking, and I think also his behavior is something that, you know, would get most people thrown in jail at this point. But I also think what's appealing is that just when you think this guy is as rotten as they come, his humanity comes out. He really doesn't just want to sleep with women. He enjoys the company of women. He enjoys their perspective. And I think he has a certain loyalty, and he has conviction. It doesn't always come out in the most politic way, but he does have a set of his own ethics.
I remember at one point I was watching with my wife, and she said... one of the things about the show that she appreciates is how lucky she feels not to have had to been a woman in an office, you know, at that time. Because it's real. I mean, that's what it was like.
It is real. He asked me, Draper does, early on. I think maybe the first episode. He says, what do women want?
What do women want?
And
who cares?
And then I say, you know what they want?
Everything.
Everything.
Especially if the other girls have it.
Trust me, psychiatry.
Trust me, psychiatry is just this year's candy pink stove.
It must have been a brutal time. I've spoken with women who worked in offices that time, and they said it was every bit as brutal as portrayed.
Can you give us any hint of what we should expect in season 5?
I wish I knew. I have no idea. I spoke with Matthew Weiner yesterday, and I know he hasn't started writing, so I think there's a bit of the chaos theory involved in the way he writes, too. I think he gets backed up to a certain point, and... filled with whatever emotion fuels the fire, and then he gets going.
That's actor John Slattery. He plays Roger Sterling on the hit AMC TV show Mad Men. He spoke to us from our bureau in New York.
One of my favorites, there's one here that's talking about my wife.
Oh, I bet you do.
I think I'm trying to pick up Joan.
Why didn't I call you later?
The office manager, of course.
Right.
Joanie. Are we actually going to get in a fight over a movie?
He says, Mona had a dream once.
You know Mona had a dream once where I hit the dog with a car? She was mad at me all day. And I never hit the dog. We don't even have a dog.
And you can hear John Slattery read more of Sterling's Gold at our website, npr.org.
Amid fears that radical Islam is growing in Europe, one imam in France is making waves by being too moderate. The imam of the Paris suburb of Drancy endorsed President Nicolas Sarkozy's ban on the full face covering Islamic veil. The move resulted in death threats. He's also calling on French Muslims to embrace their own form of Islam, one compatible with Western values. Eleanor Beardsley met with the imam and sent this report.
Elegant and at ease in a dark suit and white prayer cap, Imam Hassan Chalgoumi says the death threats don't bother him anymore. Maybe that's because two French government security agents are sitting with him in his office. They follow him everywhere, and a police car is permanently parked outside the home he shares with his wife and children. The 40-year-old Tunisian-born Chalgoumi is rector of the Mosque of Drancy and president of the Conference of French Imams. Chalgoumi says he wanted to become an imam since childhood, but was horrified by the Islamist terror in neighboring Algeria. After a 14-year spiritual journey through the Middle East and Europe, Chalgoumi settled in Paris. He has just published a book called An Islam for France. Chalgoumi says the vast majority of French Muslims are moderate, integrated, and peaceful, but they are afraid of the radical minority. He says France needs to build its own form of Islam.
There is often a huge gap between imams in France and their congregations, because most imams are foreigners, here for a few years, and paid by their home governments. They aren't familiar with French Muslims' worries, hopes, and fears. The West must educate its own imams and make them citizens who share the values and beliefs of their congregations.
Chalgoumi believes a French imam should be able to cite Jean-Paul Sartre and Voltaire as well as the Quran. But only 200 of the country's 1,500 imams were schooled in France. Last February, Chalgoumi publicly endorsed President Sarkozy's plan to ban the face-covering veil, known here as the burqa. Chalgoumi says the tribal garb has no theological basis in Islam, and it imprisons women and their children. After he supported Sarkozy's ban, police guards had to be stationed around his mosque to keep back groups of Muslims calling him a traitor to Islam. But Chalgoumi says the deep-seated racism against Muslims in Western societies helps to feed the radical movement. How can Muslims be expected to share values when they face daily discrimination and are lumped together to live in ghettos, he asks. Chalgoumi says France must have confidence in its Muslims. The sporting world embraced Algerian-born French soccer star Zinedine Zidane, he says. Now it's time to give the Zidanes of the political and economic world their chance. Several hundred faithful leave the Drancy Mosque after Friday prayers on a recent fall afternoon. One of the worshippers, Abdel Abdullah, calls Chalgoumi a good man.
He tries to bring people together and makes no differences between religions. That's why some don't like him. He even brings Christians and Jews here to the mosque.
Chalgoumi's closeness with the French Jewish community is what appears to enrage his detractors the most. Some snidely call him the Imam of the Jews. When Chalgoumi called on Muslims to respect the history of the Holocaust, his home was vandalized. But he says being the Imam of Drancy carries a special responsibility. Chalgoumi visits a rail car that stands as a memorial in the center of Drancy. During World War II, about 77,000 French Jews were held here in a transit camp before being deported to Auschwitz.
Sometimes when I come here, I just imagine all the men, women, and children who left from this spot and had no idea where they were going. I tell my children to listen to their voices and respect their memory. This act of barbarism is not only Jewish history, it's the history of all of us.
Chalgoumi says hundreds of Jews were saved by hiding in the Paris mosque during the Nazi occupation. He says Muslims have a moral imperative to remember what took place at Drancy and make sure it never happens again. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Drancy, France.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
After almost 2 months of reading through more than 5,000 of your short stories, we have a winner in round 5 of 3-Minute Fiction. That's our regular contest where we ask you to submit an original short story that can be read in under 3 minutes. In this round, our judge is Michael Cunningham. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Hours, and he has a new book out called By Nightfall. And Michael's been out of the country for a few months on book tour, but you are now in New York, Michael. Is that right? Is that where you
are? I am. I am back in New York.
Welcome home. While you were in the middle of this book tour, you were still able to pick our winner, which is a huge accomplishment for us and for you. But before we get to that winning story, as you know, each round of 3-Minute Fiction, you know, we've asked our judges to throw out a challenge. So can you just remind us what your challenge was for this round?
Sure. I asked people to start from the opening line. Some people swore that the house was haunted, and then close with the line, nothing was ever the same again after that.
It was amazing to see all those stories with that line. What did you think, Michael? What did you think that that challenge forced people to do?
One of the things that was so impressive to me was the very different ways people took on this particular challenge. There were a lot of sort of conventional ghost stories with creaking windows and doors and mysterious disappearances. Those were really very much the majority, though there were some very interesting sort of variations on it as well.
Michael, I think we have waited long enough. Who is the winner of round 5 of 3-Minute Fiction?
Well, after a great deal of debate, and I'd have to pause to thank every single person who invested the time and energy to enter a story, the one that has stayed with me, the one that most thoroughly knocked me out as I read it over and over and over again, is a beautiful and very unorthodox story called Roosts by Zach Brockhaus.
Roosts by Zach Brockhaus, which we actually posted on our website a few weeks ago. Can you do us the honors and read Zach's story for us?
It would be my pleasure. Roosts, Zach Brockhaus. Some people swore that the house was haunted. Almost every day for 3 weeks, we find a dead one inside of it. Bill wanted to chop it down, but Mother said no. They need somewhere safe to die. Someplace warm and maybe a little dry. It stays. The first one we found was a hoot owl. It lay inside the painted blue plywood walls, its face pressed firmly into the floor like it had dropped from some great height. That night, I saw the owl on a branch outside of my window. It was pale white and almost completely see-through, like milk in an owl-shaped glass. It shifted from leg to leg and kept looking over its shoulder. I couldn't see what it was looking for. It was cloudy and the woods were dark. The next one was a falcon of some kind. Shelby pulled an old bird book from the shelf, and we all watched as he turned the pages until we found it. "Peregrine," he said softly, and looked up. Bill looked closer. "That bird shouldn't be around here." We buried it and said grace, and that night it was on the branch outside of my window. The owl shifted, and the falcon ruffled its feathers. The next day we found 3 mockingbirds, and that night they were all there on the branch facing my window. "Shelby, come see." Shelby woke up bleary and blinked against the windowpane. "Trees," he said. Well, I looked, but the white birds were there. They were shining like moons, and the dead leaves curled away from them. We found a blue jay and a red-tailed hawk. We found a wood thrush, a scarlet tanager, and an oven bird. We started throwing them in the creek. "Not too close," Bill said. "You don't want to get that stuff on you." One night I found Bill sitting far away in the truck. "Why are these birds coming here to die?" I asked. He looked at the keys in his hand and then looked at me. "Here's as good a place as any. Maybe there's nowhere else to go." Everyone stopped going out to the birdhouse. Shelby would wait by the bird book and solemnly flip the pages for me until we found the right one. The nightingale was the last one I found. I held it in my hand, even though I knew it was poison. It was stiff, but the feathers felt soft, and I stood there a while and stroked it. After I threw it in the creek, I turned and saw Mother watching me from the kitchen. That night I watched the birds in the trees shifting uncomfortably. As they moved, they left behind faint afterimages, and the trees flickered with them like Christmas ornaments. When the peacock arrived, I knew it was the last time I would see them. It was magnificent. It glowed brighter than all the birds, and its tail feathers were as white and pure as flower. They strobed with electricity as it walked solemnly into the clearing by the blue birdhouse. They lifted one by one from the branches and slowly circled overhead. I looked over to where Shelby was sleeping. Pale shadows flickered on the wall. They circled through the trees like constellations. I wondered for a second if I would be lifted up with them and carried off into the woods. But I stayed. Then they were gone. Nothing was ever the same again after that.
Wow. That's an incredible story.
Good one,
story.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Incredible. And a wonderful read. Michael, I am glad to say that our winning writer, Zach Brockhaus, is on the line. I think he's on the line with us from Portland, Maine. Zach, are you there?
Hi, guys.
Zach, it's Guy Raz here with Michael Cunningham. Congratulations.
I really appreciate it.
Congratulations for me, too. It's a fantastic piece of writing.
Before I ask you about the story, what do you do in Portland, Maine?
I am a copywriter at an advertising agency out here.
Mm-hmm. He's written before.
And have you published anything, you know, fiction professionally before?
No, I've never published anything like that. But in advertising, it's very tight and controlled, and there's a lot of revision. Fiction writing for me is the exact opposite of that, sort of like jumping off of a dock.
Michael Cunningham, what was it about Zach Brockhaus's story that made it the winner out of 5,000? And you know, as I say, you read through about 130 finalists.
Yeah.
What was it about this one?
Well, it was the only one that involved a haunted birdhouse, for one thing.
Right.
That, of course, is the least of its beauties. It is so marvelously written, so evocative, so vivid. And I love the mysteriousness of it.
Zach, as you probably know, if you've checked the website, this story has been posted up there, and it's generated a lot of comments, more than 200 comments the last time I checked, and also a lot of speculation about what that peacock means or why you even, you know, chose a peacock as the grand finale. Can you solve the mystery? What is it?
I can answer that question by telling you sort of how I came to write this story.
Hmm.
And I grew up outside of Charleston, South Carolina, and we had a lot of cats. And as a result, a lot of wounded animals.
A lot of dead birds.
Mostly birds. Mm-hmm. And I take it upon myself that everyone I found, I would try and rescue. And I kept them all in this little rabbit hutch I had back in the backyard. And it never really ended well. And I sort of came to realize that maybe they were on their own path. And no matter what I did, I couldn't change it. So this story, in a way, is sort of me stepping back and letting all of those birds go. In the same way that maybe each of these characters is sort of stepping back and learning to let go of something.
Do you find that the exercise, I mean, your story had 596 words, right? Just under 600. did you have to slash big chunks of it out?
I did, probably 200 or 300 words.
Because I remember we asked you early on about writing short fiction.
Oh, no. It's incredible. I wouldn't have entered this contest. I would have been too daunted. You know, a short story, especially a story as short as these needed to be, it's like a bullet train. There's no room for any digression. There's no room for an ounce of fat. And I am, you know, sort of temperamentally a novelist, and I am awed by a good short story and almost congenitally incapable of writing one myself.
Zach, what do you think that, I mean, do you think that you have to read a lot to be a good writer? I mean, is that... Because you say you haven't published anything, but this is just a fantastic story that could appear in any journal, any literary journal. What do you do? I mean, do you write a lot on your own and just sort of not show it to anybody except maybe your wife?
She has seen a lot of the things I've written, but I've been a voracious reader as soon as I could pick up a book. The last contest I won, actually, was the 1982 Scholastic Readathon in Charleston.
In what
congratulations
grade?
Congratulations on that.
Second grade.
Second grade.
Yeah.
Second grade. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Zach, do you write every day?
Not for fun. No, I don't.
Yeah,
no,
I mean, obviously for your job, yeah.
But, Michael, I wanted to ask you that. I read Paul Bowles would wake up every morning at 4 and write from 4 until 7 a.m. then call it a day. Do you have a structure like that?
Yeah, I do. I do. And it's probably the only similarity that Paul Bowles and I share. But I found pretty early on that for me it was better to sort of set up a daily quota of hours as opposed to a daily quota of pages. Because some days you just can't stop and some days you can just barely choke out a sentence.
I had actually attempted to get published this year and failed relatively miserably. And actually, this short story is the first thing I've written since that abject misery of getting rejected.
So
whatever it's worth, I must have been rejected 100 times.
So did it take did it take you some time before you sort of had the confidence again to start writing again?
Absolutely. And that's what this sort of contest, maybe the rules and the parameters that were set up were sort of a safe thing for me to get back on. And
I felt I could handle it again. That sounds a little dramatic, but it was liberating in a way. And I tell you, I haven't felt this good about, just excited, I guess, about writing again in a long time.
Well, congratulations so much. That's Zach Brockhaus. He's the winner of round 5 of our 3-minute fiction contest. His story, Roosts, is up on our website along with some of our runners-up. That's at npr.org/3-minute-fiction, and 3-minute-fiction is all spelled out with no spaces. Zach, thanks and congratulations.
Thanks, guys. It's been a real pleasure.
Zach Brockhaus will receive signed copies of Michael Cunningham's books, The Hours and By Nightfall. And Michael, it's been such a pleasure having you judge this round. Thank you so much for being part of this.
I had a great time.
We did,
Thank
too.
You.
And special thanks also to our dedicated readers at the Iowa Writers' Workshop who waded through all 5,000 of those stories. We're going to take a short break from 3-Minute Fiction for a few weeks, but check back with us in December when we launch a new round with a new judge, the fiction writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Until then, you can read stories from the previous 5 rounds at npr.org/3-minute-fiction. Our program is directed today by Petra Mayer. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, who produced 3-Minute Fiction this round, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Lauren Silverman, Siri Grassley, Claudette Haberman, and our intern, Will O'Connor. The technical director is Daniel Shukin, assisted by Lauren Driller, Greg Gavin, and Cal Southworth. Melissa Goh is the weekend web producer. Our reference librarian is Key Maleski. Rick Holter is the senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. And for Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Remember, you can hear the best of this program on our new podcast, Weekends on All Things Considered. Subscribe or listen at npr.org/weekendATC. We'll be back on the radio next weekend. Until then, thanks for listening, and have a great week.